Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I am Welton Gaddy. I'm not seeking a nomination for the presidency of the United States. I'm president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, it seems like you can't turn on the TV at any time without catching a charismatic televangelist trying to wallop you with a theological message. We'll talk to a religion reporter who's been covering a scandal involving a prominent televangelist, a scandal that's been unfolding for almost 20 years. And we'll bring you the story of a modern-day martyr, an American nun who spent most of her adult life fighting for social justice in Brazil. It was a cause for which she gave her life. Plus, what is the blogosphere buzzing about this week? We're bringing you another installment of our Blogs of Belief segment, highlighting the site Blogging Faith, which is administered by the good folks over at Faith in Public Life. But first, it's another week and another election. And while it appears that things have become settled in the Republican Party, the race for the Democratic Party nomination is far from over. And as that race has dragged on, religion continues to be dragged through the mud in a misguided, inappropriate attempt to sway voters. We talked on last week's show about a picture circulated in the media showing Senator Barack Obama in traditional Somali dress. Well, this week, Senator Obama responded by reprinting a campaign brochure describing himself as a committed Christian who believes in the power of prayer and prays to Jesus every night. Sounds like great slogans if you're running for pastor-in-chief. We've seen this brochure before. The Obama campaign used it in South Carolina. And given the Democratic Party's eagerness to regain ground they've lost from Christian communities, we'll probably be seeing this brochure and others like it all the way through November. So the race drags on. And on the Democratic side, the only thing that seems clear is nothing is clear. Thankfully, we have someone here to help us sort through it all. Gregory LaBelle is a professor at George Washington University and a veteran of presidential campaigns, including those of Gary Hart and Al Gore. He's also our friend, and we're glad to have him back here to talk about this week's election results. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's always nice to be back, Welton.
What in the world happened?
I wish we knew. I was thinking as a little bit before that if they had tapes of everything that everybody said about this race and started playing them back now, we'd all be pretty embarrassed. It's not looking anything like anybody thought it would look. At this point, we have a Republican nominee pretty much well locked up, and we're continuing to see a battle on the Democratic side between Senators Obama and Clinton. I think a couple of things. On the Democratic side, I think Senator Clinton certainly found some messages that worked. I think that she found that the issue of readiness raising the issue of whether or not Senator Obama is ready to be president became an issue. I think NAFTA came into play in this as well, and she, for whatever reasons, I think came up with the more convincing argument on that. Senator Obama had some bad press just before the elections as well. I think the Resco story out of Chicago. And the story about whether or not a contact by a member of his staff with someone in the Canadian government certainly didn't help him in terms of his image among voters. On the Republican side,
Let me ask you this. I mean, I think we all know, and I'm not trying to be insulting here, that a lot of weird religious stuff comes out of Texas. did religion play any role in what happened in Texas?
Well, I'm going to bring you back to the Republican side, okay, because that's where I think it's interesting. What we saw on the Democratic side, just to answer your question first, on the Democratic side, I think what we saw was a split, primarily a generational split, and particularly in the Hispanic community. The Hispanic community continued, stayed with Senator Clinton, as she hoped it would by and large. But if you look at within the Hispanic community, you see a difference in generations. The younger generations tended maybe to be a little bit more willing to go with Senator Obama and so on and so forth. On the Republican side, I think it's where it's interesting because we have this week and actually for a couple of races before this, but especially this in these two races, we had a guy on the Republican ticket who was all but the nominee. There was John McCain was going to be the nominee. Everybody knew that. And yet Huckabee picked up 25-30% of the Republican vote, votes by people who knew they were voting against their eventual nominee. These are Christian, by and large, Christian conservative voters. What that tells me is that McCain continues to have a problem with conservative Christian voters in his party. Mm-hmm. That has not gone away.
Is he going to try to solve that through his vice presidential choice?
That may be possible. I mean, that's one way to do it. But he's got an interesting challenge because he has two things that he has to do. He's in the unfortunate situation of still having to lock up some of his base, these conservative Christian voters, while reaching out, as he must do, to moderates and independents. And the two activities don't fit together very well. So he's got kind of a tough road to hoe in the coming weeks.
Now, did Hillary play dirty with the 3 o'clock in the morning ad?
I will say that the voters of Texas in polling suggested that she did. They is interesting because they thought after they were going to the polls that the message had been effective, that they saw Obama as being less ready on international issues. But they also felt that the again, according to the surveys, that the message was probably a little uncalled for, a little dirty mm-hmm. politics, as you say. Did she play dirty? You know, I'm probably not the right one to ask that question because that ad was modeled on an ad that was run against the guy I worked for in 1984, the same guy who did the so-called red phone ad in 1984 for Walter Mondale, mm-hmm. which raised exactly the same questions about Gary Hart produced this ad. Is it dirty politics? I guess I'd say no. It's mm-hmm. par for the course.
Okay, now this emphasis on experience. That Hillary continues to make, and that's what that ad was all about, as yeah. I understand it. Does this mean that 4 years from now that Laura Bush will be qualified to run for president?
Well, I think that's the question that Barack Obama and his campaign have to start asking. Senator Clinton's talked a lot about her experience. She's talked about something like 80 foreign trips and so on and so forth. And I think the questions have to start from the Obama campaign on that have to be, what were you doing on those 80 foreign trips? Were you negotiating treaties? Were you meeting with heads of state? What exactly? And I suspect we will find that there's less there than Senator Clinton would like us to think in terms of substance of the trips. I understand that folks are expecting that a great deal of her schedule from the time she was first lady is going to be released by the National Archives before the Pennsylvania primary. And I think mm-hmm. a lot of those questions will be raised anew and probably to some extent answered before the Pennsylvania primary.
Greg, I spent a lot of time this week on Capitol Hill and both on the House side and the Senate side, there's great concern over the continuation of this question about is Barack Obama a Muslim? Mm. And the concern is that it sets up an answer that is as inappropriate as the question. And as you know, in Texas, he ran with these big plaques saying, I'm a committed Christian.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
Well, I think that Senator Obama has been sort of forced into that situation by these sort of subterranean stories that seem to be running through the electorate that he's not a Christian, that he's a Muslim, and so on and so forth. You're absolutely right. It's an inappropriate question. It's as inappropriate a question as the questions raised about Mitt Romney being a Mormon. It shouldn't be part of this process. But Obama is, I think, Senator Obama and the campaign are stuck with having to deal with this because we know it in some areas of the electorate, it can be an effective argument against his, sadly, an effective argument against voting for him.
It's bad because the answer is in many ways as offensive to the process as the question.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, talking about offensive, let's talk about John Hagee for just a second. should McCain just disassociate himself completely?
This is another tough spot, and this relates to what I was saying a little bit ago about the challenges before Senator McCain. And I think this points to a larger issue that's going on within the white evangelical community in this country. I think that we are beginning to see the dissolution of that coalition of religious conservatives and others that the Reagan campaign was able to put together back in the 80s. And there are other – it's happening within the evangelical community, as you know. There are huge debates within the evangelical community now in terms of what should we be about? Should we begin to look at issues like poverty and environment and not just stick to all things sexual? And this is an ongoing battle within the white evangelical community. But at the same time, you've got these long-standing levels of mistrust, particularly between Catholics and some evangelical Christians, about each other's faiths. And this has raised to the surface again, and it's really ugly. And again, I think McCain is in a tough spot because you've got two, let's say, very loquacious individuals here. Donahue is certainly not a shrinking violet when it comes to defending what he thinks are the prerogatives of his faith, and I think that that McCain is in a tough spot in dealing with this.
Greg LaBelle of George Washington University will no doubt talk with you again very soon. Thanks for coming back on State of Belief.
Thanks for having me.
Later on, we'll hear the story of a Catholic nun who lost her life fighting for poor farmers in Brazil. And coming up next, we're bringing back our Blogs of Belief segment. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty, and it's time for Blogs of Belief, where we find out what's gotten the attention of the religious blogosphere. This week, we're highlighting Blogging Faith, which is the blog for the organization Faith in Public Life. For those of you who are not familiar with Faith in Public Life, they're a nonprofit organization dedicated to strengthening, these are their words, the effectiveness, collaboration, and reach of faith movements that share a call to pursue justice and the common good. Joining us in studio to tell us more about Blogging Faith is Dan Neifelt, who is a communications associate at Faith in Public Life. Dan, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you, Reverend.
This week, you wrote about the way exit polls are conducted during presidential primaries. Tell us about the campaign you've launched to convince the news media to stop engaging in religious stereotyping.
Well, we actually began on this directly after the Iowa caucuses, when Democratic caucus goers were not asked any religion questions in the exit polls, and Republicans were. And since then, there's been disparities in every single poll, and we've been highlighting it on the blog. It's mainly been evangelical leaders who have been excluded consistently. So we got together some prominent evangelical leaders, and they signed a letter to the network saying, please ask Democratic voters if they are evangelicals as well as Republicans. Mm-hmm. And we haven't gotten through. And Faithful America, which Faith in Public Life recently relaunched, we launched a petition campaign for people to sign on to, and we presented that to the networks as well.
I see.
And they keep telling us that that it's a private internal decision that they don't discuss.
Yeah, I bet. Well, you were kind enough to highlight the Interfaith Alliance's top 10 list of the worst abuses of religion on the campaign trail. I'm curious, which of those 10 incidents did you think was the worst?
Well, it's quite a list. And the ones that struck me most were the things that were perpetrated by the media. Specifically, when Soledad O'Brien asked John Edwards what his greatest sin was, that just seemed to be an opportunity to ask some very substantive questions about how faith informs values and in turn policy. And it was turned into more of a gotcha type of question. But more so than that was when James Dobson said he didn't think Fred Thompson was a Christian.
Yeah.
In particular, for a couple reasons. One is you don't know what's in another person's heart. particularly if you're not a close friend or relative of somebody. And another is that James Dobson is not a reverend. He's not, you know, he is not a theologian. He is a child psychologist, yes. Which makes me even wonder even more where he would get off saying that somebody is not a real Christian.
Yeah. Well, I see that you have written a few posts about Senator John McCain accepting the endorsement of evangelical preacher John Hagee. What upset you about that endorsement?
Well, it's not the endorsement itself that caught my attention because, you know, as Barack Obama said when asked about Louis Farrakhan's endorsement of him is, you know, if somebody endorses you, they endorse you. What I'm paying attention to most is whether the media is going to treat that with the same degree of scrutiny as they treated Louis Farrakhan's endorsement of Barack Obama.
What should McCain do?
Oh, I'm not in the business of advising the McCain campaign. I would recommend that they take a look at the record of what he's said, and to also take into account the feedback they're getting from outside groups about what they should do and do what they think is best for the campaign and the right thing to do. But that's not a determination that I'm going to make.
Mm-hmm. On your blog, what feedback has been most surprising to you?
In the comments, there's been a lot of support for people, specifically going back to the evangelicals and exit polls questions. People saying, "Oh, well, I can't believe this is happening." You know, they're kind of, you know, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy about evangelical voters. And there have been a good number of comments saying, "Wow, you know, we can't believe that this is happening." And also, those same comments came through on our petition from Faithful America to the networks.
What do you have in the works for the coming days?
Well, there is going to be more. We're going to focus more on exit polls because, you know, after Ohio and after Texas, there were not any questions about Democratic voters being evangelicals, and that's the continuation of the problem that we've been highlighting throughout the campaign. And we're going to release new data that we've dug up ourselves.
Dan Neufeld is Communications Associate at Faith in Public Life and is a contributor to Blogging Faith. We have a link posted on stateofbelief.com. Go to it. Check it out. Dan, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Reverend.
Coming up next, we'll talk to one of the most talented religion reporters in the country. He's been covering a scandal at a Christian television network for over a decade, and it seems the scandal has only made the network stronger. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss this one. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. We often refer to State of Belief as a show that features religion and radio done differently. We use that motto because too often people assume that radio or television shows about religion are really just avenues for charismatic televangelists to proselytize an unsuspecting audience. The religious right has used radio and television media very effectively for many, many years. The late Jerry Falwell, you may remember, started his old-time gospel hour on radio back in 1956. In the 1970s and 1980s, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker built a television empire around their popular religious program, PTL, until scandals involving sex and financial improprieties caused PTL's ratings to plummet, and eventually it came off the air. But other religious program has weathered scandals and stood the test of time. Our next guest is a familiar voice to listeners of State of Belief. Mark Pinsky is the religion writer for the Orlando Sentinel. He's written a book about the future of the evangelical movement. Many of you will remember him as the author of a book on the theology of the Simpsons and how much fun we had talking about that. But today, we're calling on Mark's expertise about the televangelist movement. Mark's written an article in the upcoming Harvard Divinity Bulletin entitled Teflon Televangelists. Mark, it's great to have you back on State of Belief. I have to be honest, I'd almost rather be talking about The Simpsons, but we'll talk about televangelists. Thanks for being here.
Well, Wilton, it's always good to be back, and most people say the same thing when I come to speak.
Well, tell us what you mean by the term Teflon televangelists.
It's a kind of televangelist, maybe best identified with people known as the Grassley Six, mostly but not all Pentecostal, most but not all advocates of the prosperity gospel, who, no matter how much negative publicity is generated over time, seem immune from that criticism. Their supporters, their followers, will either hear no evil or believe no evil about these people, and they continue to go from strength to strength, which is in marked contrast from the scandals of the 1980s, where you found Jim and Tammy Baker and Jimmy Swaggart, people like that, you know, collapsing under the weight of media scrutiny, either for financial misgivings or sexual misgivings.
Well, what is this Trinity Broadcasting Network? Who are they, and how'd you come to cover them?
Sure. Paul Crouch is the founder of Trinity Broadcasting Network. I tend to refer to him as the Citizen Kane of Christian broadcasting. He has founded Trinity. He grew Trinity to become the largest Christian and religious broadcasting network in the world. Spans the globe, both terrestrial, cable, and satellite. They have numerous stations and numerous more affiliates around the nation, around the hemisphere, and around the world. They're rooted in the Pentecostal charismatic tradition, although he's no longer actively a part of any denomination, like, for example, the Assemblies of God. And it's probably best known for people like Benny Hinn and Paul and Jan themselves. Interestingly enough, when they were just getting started, probably 35, 40 years ago, they were partners with another couple, Jim and Tammy Baker. And the four of them started a little TV station in Orange County, California. And somebody told me the story, never would put his name on it, so I could never put it in the paper. I did put it in my book, that he came out one time at 2 in the morning, heard a terrible racket, and it was Jan Crouch and Tammy Baker in a knockdown, drag-out fight. And he said each was accusing the other of being demon-possessed, he said, and I was inclined to believe both of them. But the two couples split up, and Jim and Tammy went on to do their own PTL, Praise the Lord, which is the name of the signature show on Trinity, and Jan and Paul went on to grow Trinity Broadcasting Network.
Do you happen to know whether they could have cast out each other's demons?
You know, well, I'm Jewish, and I try to stay out of that. That's an intramural effort that I try to stay away from. Now, you asked how I became acquainted with them. I was working for the Los Angeles Times in the Orange County edition, and it was in the mid to late 80s when the televangelism scandals were breaking on the East Coast and in the South, and I had done a good deal of investigative work, not religious work, but investigative work, and they said, well, Orange County has all these religious broadcasters. We'd like you to, you know, have a look at them. And Robert Shuler was there. Chuck Swindoll was then there. Yeah. Chuck Smith was there. And Trinity was there. And so we used to say in the newspapers, we would turn them upside down and shake them and see what would come out. And in the case of Shuler, he was basically clean. And although they were very reluctant and kind of antagonistic toward us at the beginning when our stories came out and said they were basically clean and honest, they put our news stories in their press kit, so that's how that works. But
are you still covering them, Mark?
Actually, yes. What happened was when I left the East Coast to come to the Orlando Sentinel, I thought I had left them behind me after 13 years, 14 years of writing about them, and then they followed me home. They bought a Christian radio station in Orlando, and they bought the Holy Land Experience Biblical Theme Park, and I was thrown back into the mall like Al Pacino in The Godfather 3. I keep trying to get away, and they keep dragging me back.
Listen, what do you make of Senator Grassley's ongoing investigation of televangelists who promote this so-called prosperity doctrine?
I have to say I'm a bit baffled by it, and there are people in the evangelical movement who some are offended, but others are sort of baffled. You have a Christian Republican from the heartland attacking six high-profile ministries in an election year. He's not even in the majority, so he doesn't have subpoena power without the cooperation of the Democrats on his committee in the Senate, And he's a principled guy. He's shown that in other investigations. But why he's picked this particular fight at this particular time, I have to say, is a bit baffling to me.
I want to – there's so many questions I want to ask you about religion and the election. I can't keep from doing that. But let me just see if I can simplify it and say, what is impressing you most as you watch the campaigns about the role that religion is playing and evangelicals are playing this time?
Well, I think there's a fluidity in the sector of the evangelical vote. Richard Cizik of the National Association of Evangelicals has pointed this out numerous times, and I think he's correct. I think there's a real buyer's remorse among white evangelicals about George Bush. I think they picked belief over competence, and in private they will acknowledge that they did that to their regrets. Now, how that will play out is a little problematic. I think if the nominee is Hillary, the likelihood of her picking up any white evangelical support in the Sun Belt, at least, I think, is tiny. I know there was a poll that suggested otherwise, but I mean, most people that I talk to in this part of the country, white evangelicals, see her as the Antichrist or Ms. Mm-hmm. Antichrist. And it's said that for her to get white evangelical votes in the Sun Belt, she'd have to take up serpents and walk on water at the same time to pick up 15%, and I'd still be skeptical about that. Obama's a different matter. I think there's an openness to Obama among some white evangelicals, and the political calculus across the Sun Belt is such that you don't, for a Democrat to win, you don't need a majority of white evangelicals. If African Americans support the Democrats, which they generally do, and liberal whites support the Democrats, and they generally do, you only need, depending upon the demography of your district or state, 15% to 30% of white evangelicals to flip in order to turn a red state or district blue. And I think there's some openness toward Obama that I sense. I can't quantify it, and so I don't want to go too far out on the limb. And at the same time, I think with McCain, there's not the personal identification and affection that there was for Bush, at least in 2000.
Will they stay home on McCain, the evangelicals?
I think the jury is really out on that. I think it depends, for example, on who he picks for his vice president. Does he go for the base, or does he go for crossover mainstream? He'll send a signal. I think Huckabee had a shot at it, and now my sense is that Huckabee, by staying in as long as he did, I think he may have talked himself out of a job. Whereas the governor of South Carolina, Sanford, I think seems to be a front runner now. And he's someone who evangelicals trust, and given McCain's age and his health history, they look at that a little bit differently.
Quick answer on this one. What's going to happen to the Florida delegates in the Democratic primary?
I have no idea. I mean, I think it's just an ongoing fiasco. This is the inclination of the Democrats to, when they are asked to form a firing squad, they form a circle.
Mark Pinsky is the religion writer for the Orlando Sentinel. His article in the New Harvard Divinity Bulletin is entitled Teflon Televangelist. It's always a pleasure to have him on. Mark, thanks again for being with us on State of Belief.
Well, Welton, it's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
Still to come, we'll hear about a Catholic nun who gave her life in pursuit of social justice work in Brazil. It's a touching story. Stay with us. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. When I hear the term martyr, I often think of famous religious leaders who are chronicled in history books or perhaps whose images appear in stained glass windows. Rarely do we hear of martyrdom taking place within our own times. But recently I came across a story about a modern-day religious hero, and it's a story I wanted to share with you. Sister Dorothy Stang was born and raised in Ohio, but she spent most of her adult life serving as a Catholic missionary in Brazil. As part of that ministry, she fought for social justice on behalf of poor Brazilian farmers living in the Amazon rainforest who had to stand up to greedy loggers and land developers. It was a cause she gave her life for, literally. Though she was denounced as a terrorist and called a communist because of her work, Sister Dorothy persisted on her mission for many years until two gunmen shot her six times on a rural Amazon road. Sister Dorothy Stang's life is the subject of the new book, The Greatest Gift, The Courageous Life and Martyrdom of Sister Dorothy Stang. The author of that book is journalist Binka LeBreton, and she joins us now by phone from California to talk more about this remarkable story. Binka LeBreton, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much.
Why did Sister Dorothy end up in Brazil?
You know, she always wanted to do something wonderful for God, and she wanted to be a missionary, and she had planned to go to China, but by the time she was old enough to be a missionary, that door was closed, so she went to Brazil instead.
And why did journalist Binka LeBreton focus on Sister Dorothy for a book?
Because journalist Binka LeBreton lives in Brazil and does the same sort of work that Dorothy does, that's conservation and human rights work. And I was in the States 3 years ago when I heard of Dorothy's death, and I thought this was a story that I needed to investigate.
You know, Binka, it's hard, I think, for some of us to understand, I guess, two dimensions of this. Why poor farmers are at such risk in the Brazilian rainforest, and why a missionary's work with those farmers would put her at such risk. Will you deal with both of those for a second?
With pleasure. The question of why the small farmers' lives are at risk, it can be summarized in one short word, which is greed. Even in the Amazon, land is not infinite. And while the largest landowners in the Amazon own or claim to own pieces of land the size of Rhode Island, they're always wanting more because the value of the land is going to have to increase.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the small farmers who come in and are given grants of land by the government are a nuisance as far as the large farmers are concerned, and therefore need to be discouraged, which may involve burning them out or beating them up or even killing them.
Now, how did she help these farmers?
She helped them in two ways. One was by giving them courage and confidence to work together because they were isolated bands of people from different parts of Brazil. And if they worked together, they could make changes and they could persuade the government to give them the land titles which the government had promised them.
And who was it that was so offended by that they would want to kill her?
The large landowners, the politicians. In Brazil, land owning is still a badge of status and respectability. And they felt that she was an interfering foreign woman who was doing the job that the government should be doing, but in fact was incompetent to do, and therefore needed to be discouraged.
Now, I understand that helping farmers was not the only part of her missionary work. Would you tell us something about her work on behalf of women in Brazil?
She comes from an order, the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur, and their mission is to work with the poorest of the poor. And they identified the women and children as being the real victims of grinding poverty. Brazil is a very macho country. So Dorothy and the other sisters worked with the women to help build their self-confidence and help them work together to improve their lot.
In addition to poverty, are women considered second-class citizens in the Amazon?
Absolutely, and I think Dorothy identified with this in a way because as a nun, she felt that she was considered as a second-class citizen in the Catholic Church.
The challenges that she was facing seem so terribly daunting. Did Sister Dorothy ever doubt whether she, as one person, could make a difference?
I think there must have been moments of doubt and despair. But she drew her strength from the fact that the women particularly were banding together and that they were making a difference. And it might have been one step forward and two steps backwards, but they were still, you know, they were on track.
Benko, what are your interests in the Amazon region that made you want to look at her work?
I live and work in the rainforest in Brazil, not the Amazon, but the Atlantic forest. So I'm deeply involved in the question of conserving the wonderful resource that is the forest and also making sure that the people live there have enough to make a living. And what attracted me to the Amazon was I had started writing books about, first of all, about the forest and then about environmental rights, who owns the forest, and then the land conflicts. And then I did a book on modern-day slavery in the Amazon. So it was just a logical extension when I found a modern-day heroine who was really making a difference in the Amazon.
What message do you hope readers will take away from Sister Dorothy's story?
I would like readers to understand that an apparently very ordinary person like you or me or Sister Dorothy can take a stand with the poor and work in the case of social injustices to bring about justice and can make a difference.
Benko, what did writing this book do to you?
It made me feel very humble.
You think about her often?
I do. I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say when we finally meet.
Benko LeBreton's new book is The Greatest Gift, The Courageous Life and Martyrdom of Sister Dorothy Stang. Benko, thanks so very much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you all.
Well, that's our show for this week. Remember to stay in touch with us at stateofbelief.com. Go to the Contact Us page to send us an email, or you can call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, which means this show is supported by members of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. And while you're there, I hope you'll think about becoming more than just a listener to State of Belief. I hope you become a member of the Interfaith Alliance. Next week, the editor of the excellent website BeliefNet.com, Stephen Wallman, will join us for a conversation about the Founding Fathers' approach to religious freedom and the resulting culture war that continues to this very day. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.